The term astral matter, so called for lack of a better word to express the difference between spiritual and material matter, is used to describe that coarsest and the most grass form of astral life found in the earth plane and in close proximity to material life, whose elements mix largely in the formation of those astral bodies, which form a second shell, as one may say, to the soul, during its life on earth and on the earth plane. This gross form of astral life being mixed largely with physical atoms may be, and often is, perceived by clairvoyants of a low degree of power, and being thus seen, is often mistaken for the true soul envelopes of those who have passed from earth life, and who may even have passed to the second sphere, leaving this astral shell to disintegrate alone. Jalaluddin and those great teachers of the occult Hindu whom he had spent many years in patient study, were only able to search into the mysteries of this intermediate race of beings with the imperfect powers of their earth-encumbered spirits, and although they learned much concerning those beings, who approach most closely in their constitution to man himself, they were yet ignorant of the more subtle, more refined, and more intellectually created astrals who constitute the real danger attending the intercourse of man and these semi-human powers, he who would seek to make them his slaves, and to use them as tools for the furtherance of his own selfish purposes, should understand all the laws, many and complex as they are, which regulate the existence of such beings, and whoso tries to control them without such perfect knowledge, is like a man who sleeps surrounded by deadly explosives, that a single chance spark may ignite and cause his utter destruction. A perfect understanding of these spiritual laws, wherein lies man's safety from the assaults of these astral powers, can only be gained in the spheres of spirit life, and it is therefore never safe for mortals to attempt in any way to control these beings. Those who have done so in the past have, sooner or later, in earth or spirit life, paid to the full the dread penalty of their temerity. Chapter 10, Drifting Downwards. As soon as darkness approached, Jalaluddin and I began our studies. He would draw around us with his magic wand certain figures of triangles, circles, and other devices, till we were walled in by an invisible barrier against our invisible foes. As my clairvoyant powers developed, I perceived that from the point of his black wand a faint blue flame of spiritual ether flowed as he traced out each figure. The degree of materiality possessed by this flame being in exact proportion to that of the astral beings around us, served to keep them beyond its barrier, for Jalaluddin traced upon the ceiling, as upon the floor, his mystic circles, so that these two walls of flame, spreading downwards and floating upwards, formed a cage of spiritual fire within, which we sat secure, while outside prowled, like wild beasts of prey, those strange and horrible creatures, which the powerful magnetism generated during our experiments attracted, as moths are attracted to the flame of a candle. The faint blue flames would glimmer around us till day dawned, when the glorious purifying rays of the sun would illuminate the earth and put to flight those creatures of darkness and night. While surrounded by our circles of mystic fire, I would behold many visions, and more than once did I see the face of the woman whose charms had so entranced my senses. But although I strove with all my powers to discover who she was and where she lived, no sign was ever given to guide me to her, although everything I saw tended to prove the reality of her existence. To my inquiries, Jalaluddin would reply that when he consulted the stars on my behalf, the result was ever the same, and showed that the hour of my meeting with her was not yet come, that it was indeed some distance away. As yet, said he, she doth appear to me as a maid of tender years. You hast beheld her as she will be when you dost meet. But rest tranquil, O, most impatient youth. Possess your soul in patience, for you canst no more hurry on the hands upon the dial of events than you canst delay them, and at the appointed time shall your destiny and hers be fulfilled. Neither was he able to explain those other visions, which he had caused me to see. It was one thing to will that the future should be shadowed out before me, and another to rightly interpret the meaning of the things I saw. Thus, in following out first one branch and then another of mystic lore, did time glide on for us so swiftly that 4 years passed ere I had well marked its flight. Each day I sank more completely under the dominion of Jalaluddin's will, Each day did I hesitate less and less at following his example and his counsels, even when in my heart I knew them to be evil. From the first some instinct had whispered to me to beware of this man, but I put aside the warning voice and allowed myself to deteriorate more and more under his influence. I had never learned the lessons of self-control and self-restraint, and if I desired a thing I did not hesitate to possess myself of it. In the temple my nature had been repressed and crushed, in no respect taught and trained. That knowledge of myself and of the consequences which result from our own actions, which might have served as a certain restraint upon the too exuberant passions of my youth, had never been given to me. My life with the robbers of the hills had not tended to elevate my moral perceptions, and the teachings of Jalal ad-Din were still less calculated to do so. He, for certain reasons of his own, desired above all thing to degrade me to his own level, and I had no shield with which to resist the temptations with which he assailed me. As I sank downwards, so did he unmask yet more and more his real character, and show me first one dark plague spot and then another. The vices of gluttony and drunkenness did not tempt either of us, but are there not other vices even more degrading? The secret habits we indulged in at this time were such as to lower us below the level of the irresponsible brutes, even while the cultivation of our intellectual powers enabled us to control the services of those earth-bound spirits, and those denizens of the astral plane, whose moral condition placed them on as low a level as ourselves. Thus did my evil genius drag me down with him, till we had well nigh sunk into the pit of corruption together. I had become almost like a machine in the hands of this man. He had but to command and I obeyed. He would bid me behold certain things, or visit certain places, and if it was within the limits of that sphere to which I had sunk, I would at once pass into the trance state and give him the desired information. My mind and my body at last became alike enfeebled by the constant strain put upon them, and I made ever a fainter resistance to the influence of Jalal ad-Din. Let no one ever resign the sovereignty of himself, his mind or body into the hands of another, be he priest or layman. For a man's freedom is his divine prerogative, and he who yields it to another is more abject than the lowest slave. Chapter 11, The Secret of Jalal ad-Din. It was in the beginning of the fifth year of my residence with Jalal ad-Din that I learned at last the real reason why he had sought me out, and had directed all his ingenuity to bringing me down to a spiritual level with himself. I had soon learned that he had lived for a number of years far beyond the bounds of the ordinary space allotted to man, but I did not guess that he no longer found the means he had previously used for this end capable of producing the desired effect, and that each day he was growing more feverishly anxious to learn the secret of their failure. I had observed from the first a very curious change, which passed over Jalal ad-Din at times, and which of late had grown much more marked. In the early morning he would appear fresh and young-looking, but as evening drew on he would gradually change, growing years older in appearance in a few hours. His hands in particular greatly showed the appearance of age, growing withered, shrunken, and yellow as old parchment, such as one sees in the hands of very old people, for it is a strange fact that the hands will show age even when the face remains comparatively young. In the fourth year of my residence with the sorcerer this change, instead of only coming on occasionally, began to appear almost every day, and his face would even grow haggard and old while I was looking at him. On such occasions he would at once dismiss me, and shut himself up alone for some hours, reappearing with his youth again restored. Yet I could see that he was daily consumed with a growing anxiety on the subject. At last one day as we were sitting together his head fell forward suddenly, his body shrank and shriveled up into the semblance of a mummy rather than a man, while the change, which passed over his face was so ghastly and horrible that I shrank back in horror and alarm. He could not speak, but he signed to me with his old imperiousness of manner to leave the room, while the foam of passion gathered upon his lips, and his hands were clenched together in an agony of helpless wrath as he sank upon the floor. So great was my subjection to him that I did not venture to remain and offer to help him, but I hovered about outside, till I heard a scratching, scraping noise, followed by my master's voice speaking in faint and feeble tones to some invisible beings. Then, as the voice grew stronger, I strode away to my room. I did not venture down for some hours, and when I did so I found Jalal ad-Din seated on his cushions and looking once more like his former self, save for a certain haggard drawn look on his face, and a nervous twitching of his hands. Ahimsiman, said he, I regret that you shouldst have seen me under the influence of that strange mishap, but it may be that after all it will help you the better to understand what I desire to tell you. You hast been for 4 years my companion and pupil. To you have I confided secrets I have shown to no other mortal, and therefore I would confide to you yet another secret more precious than any you hast yet learned. You know that I have already lived far beyond the limits of the life lived by ordinary men, but you dost not know that 5 centuries have passed since first mine eyes opened to the light of earth. In those years I have renewed again, and ever yet again, the vital fluid, which holds together the atoms of the mortal body. Thus have I kept at bay the cold clutch of death, whose icy hand doth separate the spirit from its covering and send it forth to I know not what dark depths of hell. For those who have dared, as I, and you also, to lift aside the veil, which hides the darkest secrets of Ahriman and his angels, there awaits upon the black shores of death's stream many a vengeful fiend whose power we have defied, and whom I at least have subjugated to my will and made my slave, but to whom I myself may become subject when I enter those realms where they, and not I, shall reign supreme. Judge then, if such as I am dare to die? Think, whether unto me all means are not lawful whereby I may retain my hold upon this earthly body that serves as my shield against these evil powers with, which I have tampered, and whom I have defied. Wonder not that I seek from you, O my worthy pupil, the help, which you alone canst give. I have trained you for 4 years, you dost behold now that sphere wherein lies the knowledge I desire, and tonight you and I must seek it together. I cannot longer delay the time. I can no further prepare you, for each day I lose more rapidly the vitality I have acquired, and each time I consult the stars, I perceive that the span of my life has shortened by many days. The means I have used successfully for many years of the past have begun to fail me now. I lose my life forces more rapidly than I can renew them. Something is required that was not required at first, and you must find out for me what that element is. Tonight, as I have said, we shall seek for it. Meanwhile, do you gaze into yonder black mirror again, and let the invisible ones around us show you what shall be the outcome of our experiment. Shall success or failure be my fate? His eyes glittered as he said this, with the glare of a hungry wolf that would faintier in pieces anything whose destruction would give him the required food, and I thought within myself he would have slain 100 men if he could but extract 1 precious drop of life from each. I recoiled from him, and took up the mirror as he commanded, and waited while the mist passed over his face. What dost you behold? Cried my master impatiently. I see, said I, naught but a black cloth or curtain. I see every fold of its drapery, but it rises not to show me anything behind. O powers of Ahriman! Cried Jalal ad-Din in a voice of entreaty. O ye angels of the dark spheres whom I have served! Raise, I pray you, but 1 corner of this veil, that we may know the secret you dost hide, and learn whether life or death is hid behind that veil for me. Ahimsiman, look yet again. Dost you behold yet nothing? I looked steadily at the mirror, yet the vision changed not. No corner of the black curtain was raised, and I told Jalal ad-Din so. And even as I did so the curtain itself faded out, leaving no picture there. In vain I waited, nothing more appeared. Jalal ad-Din wrung his hand in bitter disappointment. Then rousing himself, he said, be it even so, since the oracles are dumb to me. I must be patient till tonight. I shall send Tarkir 2 days' journey from the city, that he may not spy upon us. And then you and I together will wrest from the powers of darkness this secret that they so jealously guard from mine eyes. Go you and seek repose, that you may gather up all your powers, for, methinks, that curtain, which they have shown is the symbol of silence, and they will answer no questions that we ask now. I bowed low to my master and left the room. But although I said nothing to him, I had my own thoughts as to the meaning of the vision. For to me the curtain had not seemed like unto the curtain of silence, but rather it resembled to my eyes a funeral pall. Chapter 12, the Angel of Darkness, as soon as the black slave Taki had fairly started on his journey, and it grew dark, Jalaluddin took me into the garden, and leading me to the fountain showed me where he kept his treasure and some of his most valuable manuscripts concealed. For he had always the fear that someday his house might be attacked, and he himself glad of a hiding place for his wealth, as well as his person. Those who engage in such practices as Jalaluddin, make of necessity many enemies, who would be only too glad of an excuse to attack and plunder them. My master first drained all the water out of the marble basin, and then showed me how to raise one of the large squares that paved the bottom. We saw before us a narrow flight of steps, and on descending them I found myself in a small oblong chamber like a vault. Here were a number of iron-bound chests of very massive construction, which evidently held the wealth which the sorcerer had accumulated during his extraordinary life. In other chests of lighter make, there were a number of parchment rolls. Jalaluddin took out three of these rolls, and then with my assistance carried up one of the massive chests into the house, taking the precaution, however, to close the stone before we left the fountain. The weight of the chest rather surprised me as we brought it in, and the contents surprised me still more, for it appeared to be full of large lumps of heavy metal, like a mixture of lead and silver. These my master put into a large smelting pot over a small furnace in his room, and as soon as the mass became molten, he poured it into a large mold. All the time it was melting, he continued to chant, in a low, monotonous voice, an incantation as I imagined, to those powers of evil whose aid he sought, having made all arrangements for cooling the metal, which he had poured into the mold. He led me up the narrow stairs to the tower, saying that those whom he had summoned to his aid him must be left to do their task alone. Having reached the chamber at the top of the tower, he drew the heavy hangings across the openings of windows, and having thus shrouded us in darkness, he bade me look at his hands and tell him what colors were visible to my clairvoyant sight as emanating from them. Each color, which you wilt see, doth show the presence of certain essences, which go to form the complete life fluid by whose agency the particles of the body are held together. If they are all equally balanced, then is the life force strong and vigorous, but if any are faint and pale, then will the body exhibit signs of disease, and if any of them fail altogether, so that the spectrum becomes incomplete, then must death follow within a brief period, for each element is needful to hold the whole in combination. I am conscious that one or more of these elements is wanting in a great degree to myself, which ones I cannot myself discover. Do you look then and tell me. For some moments I could behold nothing. The extreme darkness made it impossible to see with my physical eyes, and for a short time my clairvoyant sight seemed gone from me. After about half an hour of anxious watching, I began to see a faint cloud of mist hovering around the place where Jalaluddin stood. This grew into two long tongues of parti-colored flames, which seemed to pour out of his extended hands. The complete rainbow band was visible. On the top, the blue-white light was a mere thread, while the crimson at the foot was as a wire torrent of flame. The blue was small, and the gold mixed with dark streaks, like a stream that has become muddy. The life of man is sustained by a fine etheric fluid composed of three elements: the animistic or mental life essence, the astral fluid or magnetism of the intermediate magnetic plane between soul and body, and the aura or aroma of the physical plane, the material essence of physical organic life. The blending of these three constitute the perfect psychic or mediumistic nature. An unequal proportion of any of the three causes a certain disturbance in the equilibrium, which renders the mortal either too sensitive or too irresponsive to spiritual influences. The whole process of materialization and dematerialization depends on the balancing of the three elements and their action on one another. Thus, one who has a superflow of the magnetic fluid may cause objects to move around him without contact, and yet cannot help spirits to appear in material form. Again, one with a strong mental essence but a deficiency of the other may see and hear the visitants of the other plane, or project themselves into other planes, yet cannot cause the materialization of any psychic body. Yet put the two extremes together and add the soul essence and aromal essence to them, and you can create life in the physical form instantly. but the permanence of such material apparition will depend entirely on the amount of soul essence with which you can endow your creation. F. W. Thurstan, M. A. Jalaluddin's delight was great when he found that I could see this. It seemed to revive his drooping hopes and renew his courage. "Behold," said he, "your gifts are of a great and priceless value, Ahrin Zeman. Many seers have I tried, but none could behold this vital rainbow with such clearness as you hast done. Many see it in part, but few indeed can subdivide those parts into distinct threads of color. Some behold only the prevailing color of each individual person whose spectrum they can discern. Few can recognize that all colors must be present in the aura of every man, or else he would die. They see the prevailing colors and think that is all there is to see, and that therefore the full rainbow is not present in all animated nature. Do you rest passive now, while I ask a yet further test from your powers." He now approached me and drew some figure upon the floor in front of where I stood, and I saw the blue flame as it flowed from his wand, tracing it in lines of light. Then he made some passes over me, and the flames of crimson fire, which flowed from his fingers, seemed to scorch my brain, and cause a stupor to pass over me, and numb my limbs, till I grew fixed rigidly to the spot whereon I stood. And as in a dream, yet a dream with all my faculties in fullest consciousness, I heard Jalaluddin call upon the Angel of Darkness to appear. The tower seemed to rock with an earthquake. A rolling, rushing noise as of an approaching army of the unseen was heard, and I saw a brilliant star of crimson fire pass through the roof and rest upon the floor. From its heart there arose the figure of a man, a tall majestic man, clothed from head to foot in a long black mantle. He seemed to rise and rise before me, till he stood a dark, distinct figure surrounded by rays of fire. He drew aside the covering from his head and face, and I beheld once more the fearful countenance of that Angel of Darkness I had seen on my first visit to Jalaluddin. I was so completely entranced that I could not move even an eyelid, but I could see and hear all that passed, and I knew that the being who stood before me now was no mere vision reflected to me from the face of a magic mirror, but the actual spirit himself, clothed with a materiality that would have made him visible to any mortal sight, surrounded as he was by that dull glow of crimson light. As Jalaluddin prostrated himself before him, the dark angel said in a low, deep tone, "You hast summoned me, and lo, I am here. What dost you desire of me, O great spirit? Powerful angel, I ask from you the boon of a yet longer life on earth, and I conjure you, by the many years in which I have served you, that you shouldst reveal to me what are the means whereby I can attain the boon. Art you certain that the life of earth is so sweet a thing that you hast no other desire than to prolong it?" said the angel, fixing his somber eyes on Jalaluddin's face. "Yea," answered the sorcerer humbly, "yea, above all things do I desire it, for I know what the life of mortality is, but who can paint to me the life of that unknown world beyond the tomb?" "It is enough," answered the angel. "In so far as lies in my power, I grant you your petition. But know, O man of earth, that life and death are not within my power to give. Neither angel nor mortal can bestow that, since they are the gifts of the one supreme being alone, before whose almighty will, the angels of the light and dark spheres alike must bow. What I can give to you is the knowledge of the means whereby life may be sustained, and you thyself must choose them to the appointed end, be it for good or evil unto you." He struck the floor thrice with his foot as he spoke, and where his foot had rested I perceived a small thick roll of parchment rise, as though it rose through the floor. To this he pointed, saying, "Read you that scroll and follow the directions it gives you, and you shall hold within your grasp the secret, which means life or death for you. I bid you not farewell, O Jalaluddin, my worthy servant, for I foresee that we shall meet again ere long." He drew his mantle once more over his face, then extending his arms like wings above his head, the dark angel seemed to rise and soar from the tower, till the black clouds of night shrouded him from sight. I awoke from my trance, to behold Jalaluddin thrusting the precious roll within his robe, jealously guarding it even from my eyes. "Oh, Ahrin Zeman," he cried in a tone of great exultation, "you art indeed of priceless value to me. Little did I ever hope that such success as this would crown my researches. Dost you know that this scroll I have received is in the veritable writing of the greatest master of our magic art that ever lived? It had been said that when at last, weary of the life of earth, he laid himself down to die, he made those around him vow to place this papyrus roll between his dead hands and bury it with him in the tomb, that none might learn the secret he had discovered. It was also said that this man had discovered the grave of Adam, the forefather of all mankind, and that in the same grave where rest the bones of Adam, this great magician was laid to rest. Vainly have I and others sought for this tomb, that we might possess ourselves of the secret of life, which the dead master held within his dead hands. Yet ever in vain have we sought it, for who knoweth where is the grave of Adam, and how should one discover what so powerful a magician desired to keep secret? And now, behold, in mine own hands, I hold this mystic scroll, and you and I together shall test its virtues tonight. You art worthy of great recompense, Ahimsemen, for by your power was the angel able to manifest himself to me. For years have I held communion with him, yet was it ever imperfectly. His words came to me as thoughts, whose meanings I could but guess. Tonight for the first time he had spoken in the direct voice unto me. And for the first time I have beheld him dearly. And, O most precious gift of all, he had given unto me this wondrous scroll. Verily, Ahimsemen, you shall choose from my treasure chests such riches as you dost desire, and I will show you the secrets of many wondrous things. But come, let us descend, for the work of the dark spirits will now be finished in the chamber below, and we have yet much to do ere day shall dawn. We accordingly returned to the sorcerer's room, where we found the large smelting cauldron, which he had cast from the rough lumps of metal in the box, ready now for use. The exhilaration of my master was so great, and his excitement so keen, I scarcely knew him, and I thought unto myself that it was no good omen of success, for when our hopes are highest is oft the time when misfortune is nearest to our hand, and an exaggeration of expectancy, like unto Jalal ad-Din's, is most oft the forerunner of a great disaster. Jalal ad-Din trimmed carefully his lamp, and placed it on the table beside him. Then, having first thrown certain herbs into the cauldron, and added some chemicals from hermetically sealed jars, which he had brought from the vault beneath the fountain, he placed the whole mixture over the fire in the brazier, and bade me watch for 1 hour that it did not stop simmering, while he himself sat down to read the precious papyrus scroll. For about an hour he read on, and as I watched him from time to time I saw his face change its expression from one of expectation to doubt and even fear, while he glanced over at me uneasily, lowering his eyes the moment they met mine, as though he dared not meet my questioning gaze. Yet as often as I looked up, I would find him regarding me again with the same curious uneasy expression. At last he rose, and thrusting the scroll within his bosom, approached the fire, and having tested the contents of the cauldron, declared that it had reached the first complete stage of preparation. He therefore transferred it to another vessel suitable for distilling the liquid, and as it rose in steam let it fall drop by drop into a golden bowl beside the fire. Jalal ad-Din now proceeded to trace anew upon the floor his protecting wall of spiritual fire, and threw a handful of sweet-scented powder into the brazier. As the smoke arose from it, I saw a grey misty shape recoil from the precious cauldron and with a gesture of menace disappear. As I told Jalal ad-Din this, he gave a sigh of intense relief, saying, "I did not behold yonder shape, yet I sensed his presence, and I knew that were he to touch the golden bowl, all our labour would be wasted. I was too long absorbed in the reading of that scroll and had well nigh suffered one of the evil spirits to break in upon us. See, now as this mixture distills, I will tell you why it was that I left the metal pot to be manipulated by the dark spirits who wait upon me. As I left it, it was but made by mortal hands, and would have held only the material part of these ingredients I put in it. The spiritual essence that I desire above all things to preserve would have escaped. The elixir of life would have evaporated. Thus did I leave the spirits of darkness to work upon the pot, and make it suitable for our work of darkness. Each time the cauldron is made use of, it must be destroyed and cast afresh. Thrice already have I thus used it, who knoweth how many more times I shall do so. Ahensimen, do you withdraw a little from me for a time, sit yonder, near the window, for I have that to do, which I must do alone, and at the right moment I shall again summon you to draw near and lift the vessel down with me. He spoke in a voice of constraint, and again avoided meeting my eyes, while his hands trembled as with an ague as he signed to me to withdraw. His manner also had changed. The state of exhilaration had passed, and he looked haggard and anxious and ill at ease,